Welcome to Deep Roots, a Metro Art and Dublab project highlighting Los Angeles' multi-layered music histories. Each episode features a spectrum of voices connecting the city's sonic landscape from point A to B and beyond.
Eppenkamp, host of Bubblegum and Other Delights on Dublab.com and Bubblegum OD on WFMU.
And I'm Dominic Priori, author of Riot on Sunset Strip, Rock and Roll's Last Stand in Hollywood, and host of 66 Sunset Strip on Dublab.com.
Today we'll be exploring the avenues of the LA teen scene of 1965 and 1966 and beyond, the Sunset and Vine District in the Hollywood section of Los Angeles, the Sunset Strip in what was then unincorporated county territory, and today the city of West Hollywood. So much remarkable music, art, and social upheaval came from this one place at this one time, but it's difficult now to grasp how it all happened and why it stopped so suddenly. A couple of blocks from the Hollywood and Vine Metro stop were the Hullabaloo, Vito Lito's, Shelley's Manhole, the Haunted House, the Red Velvet, Brave New World, and the Hollywood Palladium, plus some of the world's most legendary recording studios.
Then, to the west on Sunset Strip, you came upon the clubs like Pandora's Box, the Fifth Estate Coffee House, Stratford on Sunset, Its Boss, the Sea Witch, Dino's Lodge, the Fred C. Dobbs Coffee House, Ben Frank's, the Playboy Club, the Trip, Whiskey A Go-Go, the Galaxy, the London Fog, Gazzari's, and the underground movie house, Cinematheque 16. A quick left turn down Doheny led you directly to the Troubadour on Santa Monica Boulevard and closer to the Ash Grove on Melrose. It was all happening at once for a couple of very enlightened years, all of this intersecting with the pop art scene centered at the Ferris Gallery on La Cienega. The motivation of overall youth culture in the LA of 1965 and 1966 was focused on civil rights and stopping the war.
It's been well over half a century since all this took place, so we thought it best in order to try and capture the excitement of this great artistic awakening to try and paint for you an audio cinemascope of the interiors and what was going on inside the clubs, along with what was important to the people who frequented them during the mid-60s. We can start it off at the traditional center of Sunset Strip near the corner of La Cienega, at an unlikely place for the counterculture to get such a foothold. But there it happened, at the former nightlife home of glamour-era Hollywood movie stars, Ciro's.
The Sunset Strip really became a thriving nightclub center directly through the editor of The Hollywood Reporter, Billy Wilkerson. Billy opened the Trocadero, an instant Hollywood movie star hangout for the elite. Then in 1940, Wilkerson opened Ciro's and now had two of the four major clubs on that stretch of Sunset Boulevard. Wilkerson's next plan was to open the Flamingo in Las Vegas, pioneering that area for Hollywood-style glamour. He quickly sold Ciro's, which for most of its following years was managed by Herman Hoover. Along with George Schlatter, they booked in all the big singers and comedians from the lounge era. Their start in the 1930s and 1940s to remain open during the 1950s. Hollywood glamour days had already begun to show declining receipts. Ciro's stayed open as late as July 29, 1958, and then it became Frank Sinis Ciro's, with a gallery opening on February 9, 1960. Suddenly, one of the most exquisite Hollywood landmarks that had previously been frequented by the posh set was now at the threshold of a social revolution. One page of the Los Angeles Herald Examiner by reporter Bob Curry said, "Recording star Major Lance tonight and tomorrow only at Ciro's La Disc with the Fabulous Birds." Ciro's buzz began that night when Bob Dylan joined Birds on their March 26th debut. Quote, "It's the Birds' first night at Ciro's," explained dancer Carl Franzoni. "We walk in the place and it's a totally red room, lots of light, the best dance floor in Hollywood. It's about 40 feet by 60 feet. All the stars in Hollywood are there. These guys have never played for them. We stepped on the dance floor, and from then on, it was music and dance for months and months." What the Birds did to Ciro's was unbelievable. They made it the place for young Hollywood. On a higher fee, they packed the place. The queues were up and down Sunset Strip, desperate teenagers clamming to get in. The dance floor was wild and a wonderful madhouse. preferred followers, wayward painters, disinherited sons and heirs, bearded sculptors, cultish, misty-eyed nymphs, with hair all over the place, suddenly taught Hollywood to dance again. Ellen Sander, a journalist, said, "The birds had changed the street. Celebrities, Mary Travers, Odetta, dancing, starlets, writers, Michael J. Pollard, were all grooving. Dylan would stop by and play with them. Those nights at Ciro's were the talk of both coasts underground, and they hadn't even hit the road yet." The message in the lyrics of most of these songs is delivered by implication, said New York Philharmonic conductor Leonard Bernstein. "This is our teenager's strongest weapon. It almost amounts to a private language. Many of the lyrics, in their oblique allusions and way-out metaphors, are beginning to sound like real poems. And protected by this armor of poetry, our young lyricists can say just about anything they care to. And they do care. They care about civil rights, about sexual freedom, about peace. They care about alienation, mysticism, drugs. But mostly they talk about love, as all songwriters have since time began." Ciro's Le Disc was taken over by Paul Raffles and Bill Doherty, who previously worked at PJ's. They immediately outfitted the legendary club with huge pop art paintings and designs. The futuristic curves of the entrance that seemed to match the contour of the street were now complemented by a groovy, bubble-shaped It's Boss neon flashing to the strip. The interior walls became eerie, moody, oversized tributes to vintage comic strips and pop stars. In the style of Roy Lichtenstein, things like Dick Tracy, Little Orphan Annie, juxtaposed with various Beatles, Rolling Stones, and James Brown color silhouettes. The schedule of shows that took place at It's Boss in 1965 and 1966 is something of a microcosm, not only of what songs were most popular on the charts at the time, but also what songs were having direct emotional impact with the general public. This was a time when pop radio audiences truly shared the same space with arty or diverse styles of music. All of a sudden, we have a feeling of being a generation and having some sort of bond with every other teenager on the street, said one young girl interviewed at It's Boss. "Maybe I feel it's different, you know, because I've never experienced another generation. But I do feel we'll have something to say and we'll make a gigantic splash in the world to come." Stemming from the heart of Dream Factory-era Hollywood, the Hullabaloo near the corner of Sunset and Vine first opened in 1938 as the Earl Carroll Theater, the most glamorous club during a most glamorous time in town. The idea was for Carroll to move his vanity show away from New York City and his main competitor, Florence Ziegfeld of the Ziegfeld Follies. The Vanities Theater concept for Hollywood embraced movie land's similarly themed Busby Berkeley dance musicals, pure fantasy plus dynamic outfits for the female dancers. In order for Earl Carroll to achieve this, his club was outfitted with the largest revolving stage in the world at the time. Carroll passed away in a plane crash a decade after the club opened, so the venue became a Hollywood version of the Moulin Rouge, with Parisian stage shows and the top lounge singers of the 50s. By 1965, the showbiz glamour era had run its course, so at the end of the year, a follow-up to the Tammy Show film, famously featuring back-to-back performances by the Rolling Stones and James Brown, was scheduled to be shot as something of a final Moulin Rouge event. Phil Spector took over as the musical director for the follow-up, the Big TNT Show. The result displayed pivotal changes embodied in the context of that time. Filming of the Big TNT Show took place on November 29, 1965. In December, the marquee was changed to a multicolored tilted block lettering that spelled out Hullabaloo, with the KRLA Beat Award Show serving as a grand reopening of the nightclub space. The Los Angeles Times headline read, "Another Sunset Strip adult hangout passed into teenage hands Wednesday evening with the opening of the Hullabaloo at what was once the Moulin Rouge. This follows the trend set earlier by Ciro's and the Crescendo, now It's Boss and The Trip, respectively." The Hullabaloo hung on to the building's original Art Deco glamour, inclusive of keeping the Moulin Rouge dark wall paintings of Paris, but adding the twist of iconographic band pictures hanging from the ceiling, including the Rolling Stones, the Supremes, and the cover shot from the Beatles' brand new Rubber Soul album. Quick time, the huge venue would host performances by the Yardbirds, Them, James Brown, Ike and Tina Turner, and Bang Records recording era performances by Van Morrison and Neil Diamond. In the mid-60s Los Angeles, hordes flocked to shows anywhere by the music machine. But according to band leader Sean Bonniwell, the best one took place at the Hullabaloo. Richard Pryor, a tough act to follow, opened the show with a wild, lengthy, and encore field performance. When the stage turned around, the music machine were lying on the floor, pretending to be asleep. They woke up and tore through their most ominous set ever. The avalanche of excitement the group achieved in person came from a neat trick thought out in advance. There were no breaks between the songs for the entire set. Quote, "The original Music Machine album was supposed to have no cue gaps in between songs," Sean Bonniwell clarified. "I wanted the album to be the same as the group was live. That's why I called it the Music Machine. We were the first band to play an hour of non-stop original music with musical segues and everything. They thought I was nuts.
I got me a complication, and it's an only child. Consume my reputation as something more than what. I know it serves me right, but I can't sleep at night. Have to hide my face or go some other place. Yeah, 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 yeah. I won't cry out."
The Hullabaloo was one of the few clubs that did stay open after the Sunset Strip riots, but it was tough with constant hassles from the authorities. There was one crazy way of dealing with the situation, and the Hullabaloo could do it because the building came with club zoning codes left over from Earl Carroll's original contracts with the city in 1938. The Hullabaloo had permission to run a show literally all night long. As documented by a February 25, 1967 article by Renata Adler in The New Yorker, the Hullabaloo's new after-hours club featured 13 scheduled groups between 2 a.m. and 6 a.m., including the Sound Machine, the Mandala, the Peanut Butter Conspiracy, Smokestack Lightning, and Love. The New Yorker also reported, quote, "Directly across the boulevard from the Hollywood Palladium was so full of the long hairs waiting outside, occupying the entire block, not in any sort of line, but extending radially over the area. A parking lot beside the Hullabaloo was full of cars, nearly all of their radios on. So a kind of concert of Donovan, the Beach Boys, Sonny and Cher, and the Buffalo Springfield was rising from the asphalt.
On the streets you look again at the places you have been, for the moments that you thought, where am I going? Though the walls are like the dead, they reflect the things you said, and the echoes in your head continue showing. Hear the castles you can build out of dreams you have fulfilled, or keep out all of the ill wind that is blowing. And you look still for a trace of an opening in a place where you find the life that you were used to knowing."
The story of the trip really begins with a room that in 1954 was the first move away from the glitz and glamour of the movie star elite and into a hipper, more jazz-oriented crowd. Progressive ownership of the original club in the building, called the Chanticleer, was taken over by British actor Lewis Hayward and his silent partner and co-owner, jazz singer Billy Eckstine. As an African-American during the early 50s, Eckstine would not have been allowed to run such a place on the Strip. After establishing the location, they soon sold to Gene Norman, an insightful booker of jazz shows, who renamed it the Crescendo. Upstairs was an annex club Norman called the Interlude. The artists took emphasis, and the Crescendo was booking people like Duke Ellington, Count Basie, Art Tatum, June Christie, the works. twist came in, Crescendo got the booking for Chubby Checker. But by 1963, the original jazz vibe and Gene Norman had checked out of the building. A new version of the club reopened in May of 1965 as the Crescendo Tiger Tail for teen appeal. Covering the opening, Los Angeles Magazine recognized exactly the juxtaposition between the old and the new. Quote, "A nightclub for the new generation dreamed up on the site of the old Crescendo by Whiskey Go-Go's owners when they saw the shift coming from rock and roll to folk rock. In April, Donovan came to the club right as he was getting his psychedelic edge on. He would write and release a song called The Trip, reflecting his experience during this engagement.
We was a do-do-do driving to downtown today, about a midnight hour, and it almost blew my mind. I got caught in a colored shower. Those lights were to twinkling on sunset. I saw a sign in the sky. I said to trip, trip, to trip, to trip, I trip, trip. I couldn't keep up if I tried. We stopped at a reality company to get some instant sleep. And the driver turned and said, welcome back. Smiled and he said, beep, beep. What goes on? Cheek, cheek.
The Trip had opened with a bill featuring Eve of Destruction singer Barry McGuire with the Where Were You When I Needed You, Mr. Jones era grassroots and support. The Birds played almost the entire month of October, alternating with the Leaves and opening act MFQ. The Love and Spoonful were back in the room to start November off, and then there was a series of shows by Smokey Robinson's group, The Miracles, November 12th through 17th. Local artist Billy Preston opened. Marvin Gaye sauntered through for a run November 18th to 27th. Wilson Pickett was next at the Trip with his band for an engagement beginning January 21st going through to the 30th. Sam the Sham and the Pharaohs took the stage February 3rd through the 12th, followed by the Temptations February 13th through 27th. The Temps were followed into the Trip with a stint by Martha and the Vandellas, who did Dancing in the Street during March. The important thing is the music and to dance, wrote No One Here Gets Out Alive author Jerry Hopkins. The most controversial show to take place on the Sunset Strip happened in early May. As far as the authorities were concerned, it was the beginning of the end. The most cosmic experience to take place at The Trip was an engagement by Andy Warhol's Exploding Plastic Inevitable, featuring the Velvet Underground and Nico. The audience was filled with people from the Ferris Gallery art scene who put on Warhol's first show in 62. Plus, a diverse array of movie stars, including Dennis Hopper, who crossed over from movies to art. Music people, celebrities, and go-go dancers from the rock and roll TV shows were all there, too. "I love L.A. I love Hollywood," Warhol told the Los Angeles Times' Kevin Thomas. "They're beautiful. Everybody's plastic. But I love plastic. I want to be plastic." Thomas said, "The show took on a ritualistic, incantatory quality. Everybody but everybody was turned on. Films projected on three screens, leather, ropes, and foil, plus Gerard Malanga and Mary Warnoff go-go dancing. It was Malanga and Warnoff's whips that caught the attention of the police. And after only four shows, the Velvet Underground's nearly month-long engagement and The Trip were both shut down."
There she goes again. She's knocked out on her feet again.
You are listening to Deep Roots, illuminating the intersectional music histories of Los Angeles.
September Pandora's Box as the rallying point for the 1966 Sunset Strip riots. It was also the epicenter for the club that best embodied the spirit of 1960s garage punk music. But the club had a life before that. Bongo rock hitmaker Preston Epps led the main house band for years and played a combination of jazz, R&B, calypso, and soul, along with his own instrumentals. It simply promised dancing 7 nights a week. Les McCann Limited had a steady jazz gig there during the 50s, and later like a folksy beatnik crowd. Most of the groups that became famous in the 1960s sprang from neighboring clubs on the strip. Pandora's Box had no such claim to fame. This little pink striped house with the purple logo sat on a traffic island at the crossroads of Crescent Heights and Sunset Boulevard, a very busy intersection at the virtual entrance to the strip. If you were driving from the valley via Laurel Canyon, it was the first sign of Sunset Strip nightlife as you descended the Hollywood Hills. In contrast to the Sunset Strip's early movie star exclusivity, Pandora's Box represented the dawn of opportunity for rock and roll era baby boomer teenagers. It carried with it a sense that anyone could play and would not be shut out of the Hollywood experience. The do-it-yourself aspect of Pandora's Box had a huge emotional impact on LA rock and roll. This triangular traffic island always seemed on the very verge of excitement, the zero cool tip of the iceberg. The Beach Boys played Pandora's for a month in October of 1962 on a series of shows presented by KFWB DJ and future Shindig host Jimmy O'Neill. In 1965, the KRLAB made note of how O'Neill pioneered the idea of a teenage nightclub and started a whole new trend in youthful entertainment at Pandora's Box. Began to feature more garagey fare when a no age limit policy change took place in June of 1965. This was the exact moment that Ciro's Le Disc became its boss, and the Crescendo interlude reopened as the Crescendo Tiger Tail, and both Gazzari's on the strip and the Haunted House debuted. Unlike the larger rooms of the strip, Pandora's Box would most often headline with groups that had yet to make a record. With the no age limit policy change, Pandora's Box hired the band, B-A-N-N-E-D, as their Friday night house band. A parade of similarly obscure groups alternated with the band for the Pandora's Box house band slot on Saturdays, such as the Ants, Us, the King Bees, the Sloths, the Knack, ESP, and the Ladybugs.
But that was yesterday.
In 1966, Pandora's Box hired a new house band from Monrovia called World War III. It featured ace guitarist Jim McGrew, who could play just about anything. I was in high school, and it was the most happening spot in Hollywood, the band's drummer Bobby Figueroa recalled. They didn't have a marquee, so they hung up this tarp on the white picket fence to sensationalize the band name. World War III, you know? It got people's attention. But all this fun was too good to last. After months of teenagers getting hassled on the strip for no real reason, loitering, having long hair, wearing colorful clothing, staying out late at night, listening to loud music, the city started to seriously crack down on the music scene.
Just don't seem fair to bug you because you got long hair. Even the parents are beginning to scare because of the siren.
In May of 1966, the Velvet Underground and the Exploding Plastic Inevitable flew out from New York to play a month-long engagement at the Trip. The Andy Warhol contingent's weird music, light show, druggy references, and stage show featuring whips and mock S&M action was too much for County Supervisor Ernest Debs, who was looking for any excuse to close these damn nightclubs down. This was all part of his nefarious scheme, right out of the movie Chinatown, to restructure this unincorporated part of West Hollywood into a more lucrative financial center. The police shut down the VU residency 4 nights in, and the heat only intensified. Soon after, teens were busted at the coffee shop Googies for the crime of hanging out, and a bigger altercation occurred when cops cracked down on them for noshing at Cantor's Deli. These types of incidents led to press coverage, which resulted in rumors that a teen curfew and a moratorium on nightlife might go into effect. Soon, the people, these were mostly white middle-class teenagers, began to plan peaceful protests. The place? Sunset Strip Central, Pandora's Box.
Where are the kids gonna go? Hang out on the streets? Go home and get drunk or something with their mother and father? No. But they've gotta show some form of expression, something that they can say, well, this is what's happening now. Where are they gonna go?
February 11, 1967, 3,000 people met at Pandora's Box to protest against the treatment of young people in Los Angeles. But this was in solidarity with a larger movement that synchronized demonstrations for the rights of Chicanos, Blacks, gays, anti-war activists, and other groups in Watts, East LA, Pacoima, Venice, and Silver Lake. Then the musicians behind the Pandora's Box riots organized the CAF benefit, a concert to raise awareness about the issue and gather money to pay for protesters' bail and legal expenses and damage done to local businesses. The concert on February 22, 1967 was at the Valley Music Theater. It featured performances by Peter, Paul, and Mary, The Byrds, Buffalo Springfield, and The Doors. The success of the CAF concert led the organizers to keep on. Their next project, a little soiree called the Monterey Pop Festival, that featured legendary performances by Jimi Hendrix, The Who, Janis Joplin, The Mamas and the Papas, and many other acts. Monterey Pop was the defining moment of the Summer of Love and the birth of the Rock and Roll Music Festival.
I was in a band called the GTOs that Frank Zappa produced, and I am considered to be the world's most famous groupie because I dated a lot of guys in bands. And I was hanging out on the Strip all through the 60s into the 70s. So that's me. I was there the night the riots took place at Pandora's Box because they were going to close our darn club, and we were not happy about it. It had a cute little picket fence around it and a yard we could all hang out in, the smoke pot, and just get together and be together. It was a brand new form of interaction between young people. We were considered hippies. I don't know if they were calling us that yet. It was pretty early, but we were just young people trying to have a fun together. It was a lot of social interaction at this club, and it was an underage club, which was pretty rare on the Strip. So we were very pissed off that they were going to close our club. And there were pamphlets going around for a few nights before so we could, you know, rail against the cops and the authorities for closing our club. And they were closing it because they weren't going to put a three-way turn signal. But I think there was more to it than that. They did not like the kids, thousands of teenagers milling up and down the Sunset Strip. A lot of the businesses were unhappy about it because none of us had any money to spend. So I was very excited about going to the riot, the protest, shall we say. And I got there right as it was in full force. It was just thousands of us. All the kids that were up and down the Strip, including Rodney Bingenheimer, Kim Fowley. I saw Frank Zappa and his wife there that night, and I was just beside myself. I hadn't met him yet, of course. Sonny and Cher, various band members, local bands. Anyway, it was really thrilling to be there, and I felt like part of a revolution going on. it was way more than just closing the club. It was this uniting of you know, flower power, peaceful, trippy hippie souls coming together. And we sat cross-legged on the street on Sunset Boulevard, which stopped traffic in every direction. And we were, had signs. I didn't have a sign, but many people around me had signs, waving them around. And we were all just screaming and yelling and laughing. And, you know, it was quite an event. There were also love-ins going on around this time. So it was very much like a love-in. Some of the beautiful Hollywood boys that I was crazy about actually turned over a gigantic bus right at the corner there where there's a bank. And no one was in it, though. No one wanted to hurt anyone. But, you know, it was quite a protest. And about, you know, after about probably 90 minutes of this madness, the cops started marching in formation up Crescent Heights Boulevard with their batons. And when they got to all of us kids cross-legged in the street, they started beating on us. So, of course, everyone scattered. And then they tried to give us a curfew. And it probably stuck for a couple of weeks, some 11 o'clock curfew, which just wasn't going to happen. And that was that. That was the riot. They closed the club anyway and put on the three-way turn signal. And, of course, Stephen Stills wrote the song about it, but he wasn't there. Apparently, he was in his van trying to get there. And, of course, when he got there, there was no way to park anywhere. He saw all the madness and went home and wrote a song about it. But he was not there with us protesting and marching and, you know, waving signs or anything. But that's where the song For What It's Worth came from. That song is about that riot.
Something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
I was hanging out on the strip with a few of my girlfriends. I was very young. I wasn't even 17 yet, or I may have just turned 17, and the Birds were playing Syrup, which was it was a very fancy club, you know, where Sammy Davis Jr. played and people like that. At this time, it was 21 only, and I couldn't get in, of course, but I wanted to see the freaking Birds. So there was a backstage door that faces the strip, which still does, only now it's a comedy store. And I said, I'm just going to knock on that door and see what happens. And my girlfriends were saying, you can't do that. Oh, my God, you can't. Of course, I did it. And the door swung wide open, and Roger McGuinn, his name was Jim at the time, saw me standing there and handed me a joint and said, come on in. So I was backstage, very tiny backstage, with all of the Birds and the roadie, and that was it, and me sitting there. So this was a moment where I thought, you know, I could do anything.
People tried to tell me what they think is right. I don't listen to them. Turn no day from night. I go through life searching, trying to find the one. I go slip, slip, you go slip, slip away.
Hi, this is Johnny Eccles from the group Love, here to share with you my recollections of a club called Beetolitos. Just off Cahuenga Boulevard on a side street called Cosmos Alley, Beetolitos, an anagram for Bill, Dorothy, Linda, and Tommy, the family that owned the club, was an important part of the West Coast rock scene. at least as important as CBGB's was to the East Coast punk scene. This tiny family-owned restaurant slash nightclub played host to some of the most iconic and successful rock groups of all time. On any given night, groups like The Doors, Buffalo Springfield, The Seeds, Iron Butterfly, and of course Love could be heard rocking the house from blocks away. The first group to play the club, and young folks came from far and wide to be a part of the scene. Love, at the time, was a loud, brash, guitar-driven rock band, fronted by singer Arthur Lee and lead guitarist Johnny Eccles. They were among the first racially mixed rock and roll bands in Hollywood. Beatolitos was cramped, deafeningly loud, and in the middle of Hollywood, across the alley from an iconic jazz temple called Shelley's Manhole, and about a mile from the world-renowned Grauman's Chinese Theater. The club was a mecca for young people who flocked to the area to see and to be seen.
Hey, you, child standing over there. Girl, you look so good. Yeah, you look all right. Hey girl, hear me calling your name. Baby, the way you walk, see you drive me insane. Oh, you look so good.
Beatolitos was actually quite small inside. Only about 75 to 100 kids could squeeze themselves inside like sardines. And the courtyard outside could maybe hold another 100. So the vast majority, numbering in the hundreds, packed themselves into the alley itself. And that's where the main action was. There were huge Voice of the Theater speakers strategically placed, so the music was just as loud on the outside of the club as it was on the inside. Here, young people ruled. They had free rein to let it all hang out, and that's exactly what they did. It has been described as a freak show. Kids in all manner of dress could be seen strolling up and down Cosmo's Alley. And because the club was located in an alley, unlike other parts of Hollywood, namely the Sunset Strip, there were no other businesses in close proximity to interfere with them just being themselves. The counterculture flourished here. Young folks from all over Los Angeles, mostly through word of mouth, found their way to Beatolitos by way of Cosmo's Alley, which in itself has a long and storied history, dating back to the time of Charlie Chaplin and other icons of the silent film era. Due to the fame or infamy of Beatolitos, Cosmo's Alley has enjoyed a resurgence and is now hailed as iconic, legendary, a place of monumental significance to the history of rock and roll.
Everybody's gotta live, and everybody's gonna die. Everybody's gotta live. I think you know the reason why. Sometimes I go and get so good, then again it gets pretty rough. But when I have you in my arms, baby, you know I just can't get enough. Oh yeah.
In a sense, the atmosphere inside Sunset Strip nightclubs of the middle 60s was the beginning of popular culture going beyond mere entertainment and into the realm of political activism and social consciousness.
The activism and organization that led to the Sunset Strip demonstrations in November 1966 led directly to the organization of the Monterey Pop Festival in 1967, an unprecedented event that defined the Summer of Love and the model on which Woodstock was based. Movements such as Occupy Wall Street and Black Lives Matter are a continuum of the concept that a socially conscious youth culture can make a difference and has been the most important aspect of what really began outside Pandora's Box at the Sunset Strip riots.
We hope you enjoy taking this trip down the 1960s Sunset Strip. Thanks for listening to Deep Roots. This has been Becky Eppenkamp and Dominic Priori for Metro and DubLab.com.
She said, if you're with me, I'll never go away. That's when I stopped and I took another look at my baby. She said, if you're with me, I'll never go away. Because everybody's gotta live. And everybody's gonna die. Everybody's gotta live. Before you know the reason why. I had a dream the other night, baby. I dreamt that I was all alone.
This is Deep Roots, exploring the music histories embedded in the Los Angeles landscape. To learn more about DubLab's progressive programming and community-driven artistic amplification, visit DubLab.com. For more on how Metro Art enriches transit journeys through the visual and performing arts, visit metro.net/art.
Vas manejando y adelante a tu derecha va una mujer en bicicleta regresando a casa del trabajo. Hay poco espacio, no hay carril para bicis y hay coches estacionados. Sabes que debes darle 3 pies de distancia a los ciclistas y fijarte bien antes de cambiar de carril para rebasar con seguridad. Sigue atento y recuerda que hay que compartir la calle con los ciclistas. Seamos respetuosos. Visita gohumansocal.org.